I'm going to start by asking you about the poems that we've just heard, Mimi. I wonder if you could say a little bit about your choice of Wordsworth. Why that poem? Why Wordsworth?
I feel so sort of dumbstruck. I mean, it's so beautiful, you know, that I wish I could just sit and listen. But anyway, okay, I have to open my mouth. Yes, Wordsworth. Well, Wordsworth, I came across him at school, of course, along with the other romantics. And although at the time I think I loved, well, not all of them. I loved Keats and Wordsworth, but never going to Shelley for some reason. But Wordsworth always just stayed with me. He's probably the only poet that I've been faithful to, you know, through all these decades. And that poem in particular, I think it's the sort of the epitome of, you know, the Wordsworthian thing. And I don't know why it's sort of... I find him the most companionable of poets. I think this is it. You know, he makes me feel like, he's just sort of talking to me as we walk through the hills and the valleys and the meadows and the woods and all that kind of stuff. So, and I think he has this lovely quality of turning what might be something not so comfortable, such as loneliness, into solitude, and then solitude into companionship. So, and I grew up, you know, on the Isle of Wight, with all its sort of hills and downs, and it was quite rural, I suppose. So, it's this feeling that he was sort of vaguely there in the air around you. And I love the music of Wordsworth, which I know people go on about Wordsworth, you know, this sort of ponderous old, you know, thing thumping on about stuff. But, the sensation for me, actually, of his voice and his poetry is, I was rereading it and thinking, what I really like is that it sort of creeps low on the ground. You know, it's sort of like sort of ivy ground cover or something. It just spreads. The sounds stay low. You know, they don't sort of rise up like this. I mean, not to my ear anyway. So it is a bit like the murmur of the brook in the background. And it's this sort of murmuring. He uses the word murmur quite often. And I think that's what I like about it, that in a way it disappears itself, you know. Of course, all that pantheism and everything I find very attractive, but ultimately I think it's always the sensation of something that, you know, makes me feel connected or not, more than other things, rather than the philosophy or the ideas, or, which also I'm obviously... it's, you know, sympathetic to. Is that good? Have I said enough?
No, I'm going to go back to it now and listen for that ivy type.
Yes, it's hard to explain, isn't it? But I don't know. I tend to like small things. I like low things, maybe because I'm not very tall. You know, that's sort of my sort of eye-thick level is, you know, but... yes, I have this sense that it just sort of murmurs, you know. Now I have felt a sense of rhyme or something formal and something. You know, it sort of murmurs in this way through the blood. And that's why I think it's always with me.
And the Louise Gluck. She's probably a poet that some people here may not have heard of Louise Gluck, but... could you say a bit about your choice?
Yeah, well, she's complete opposite, I would say. I think she's very vertical. I've never seen her. She's probably very tall. But sort of poetry is it goes on that vertical axis, but particularly this book, The Wild Iris, you know, between earth and some deity up there. So it's more like ivy binding itself round a pole ever upwards, you know, and I can't say I like it, but I'm very awestruck by it. And I think, especially as a woman poet, her voice has this tremendous, rather chilling authority. And a kind of, I think that's sort of wonderful. You know, it's authoritative and delicate. It's not gentle, but it's delicate and authoritative at the same time. And in this book, particularly in which she speaks in the voice of flowers or of abstract nouns such as retreating light or early morning light, and the voices are always in the voice of something other than herself, well, most of them. And so she can invest, it seems to give her permission to invest the voice with this almost supernatural sort of deified kind of quality. And then she speaks to the little human beings on earth. So the whole thing of scale gets reversed, you know. So normally in the lyric, the sort of, you know, the I, the personal I, is very sort of present. Or the human eye, if you like. In this case, it's just all these wee little Lilliputian kind of figures of humans who become very tiny, and the eye is very sort of, you know. So I kind of think, yeah, go for it. I mean, do it, if you can. Yeah.
So I was thinking, just going on to your own life and work, Mimi. When do you think that poetry first sort of entered your life? I mean, either in writing or reading, but was there a particular moment where poetry really touched you, affected you? Or did it sort of creep up on you sort of gently? How did poetry first enter your life?
Well, I can think of three different sort of moments, times, really. The first, when I was quite little at school, we used to have to take part in verse recital competitions in Ryde, you know. And I remember going on the bus, you know, having to say your thing. So probably I was about maybe 7 or 8. And I think now, of course, in retrospect, I think it's hugely sort of significant, in as much as anything in my poetry is hugely significant. But I think it was the first time that, you know, when you have to recite something and you're competing with a whole load of other kids who are reciting exactly the same poem, you know, you really are then grappling with the nuances and, you know, the tiny things that, oh, well, how do I inflect this bit, or do I put a little pause there, and, oh, I didn't like the way she read that line, and, you know, so you're dealing with the minutiae of how a poem sounds. In fact, I clearly remember doing Christopher Milne's, no, A.A. Milne's, you know, the Christopher Robin thing, Sand Between the Toes, and that kind of thing. So that was the first occasion. Then the second time I connected with poetry was, you know, much older, doing school stuff, as I've mentioned, with particularly the Romantics. And then nothing at all, although, of course, I did a lot of theatre work, and only realised again in retrospect, well, actually, a lot of it was actually verse. I mean, there were verse dramas, but I didn't think of them as poetry. I thought of them as drama or theatre. And then, much later, in my 40s, I went on this Avon course. I wanted to write scripts for radio at the time. I wasn't, I was just, you know, at home with two kids and stuff. So I went on this course that was for radio writing and poetry. And when I arrived, no sign of radio writing anywhere. It was just, you know, the tutors, everyone was doing poetry. So they said, go and write a poem. And I went, Oh, all right. And that's really, so it didn't creep up at all. It just sort of, you know.
You were told to do it.
I was told to do it. So I did it. I'm very obedient.
I wonder whether it might be worth us just saying a little bit about, because you say you went to school at the Isle of Wight. But you were born in Tehran, weren't you? So
yeah.
I wonder if it might be worth just putting how you got to the Isle of Wight.
Just a sort of life sort of thing. I'm totally Iranian, so my parents are Iranian and, you know, all the rest of it. And I was sent when I was six to a boarding school on the Isle of Wight in Shanklin, Tehran Shanklin, protectory, presumably for a good English education. Mm. That's the official version.
Mm.
I don't know. and then I didn't go back really till I was adult. I went for one summer holiday in the middle there. So, you know, I forgot how to speak Farsi, you know, my first tongue, and hadn't seen my family, didn't know who they were or anything. That was it, yeah.
You mentioned your verse dramas that you were doing at drama school. Also, in your poetry, particularly, I was reading The Meanest Flower out loud recently, from cover to cover, and I was so struck by the...
You've been crying.
Yes. By the musicality. Perhaps music is also has been important in your life and features in your work.
I'm very ignorant about music. I mean, I did learn to play the piano and all the rest of it. But you know, when they, I could never say, is it this symphony or that symphony? You know, I'm hopeless in that sense. I think I'm interested, you know, foremost in writing poetry. It is the sound is the foremost thing for me, more than the sense or other aspects. But sometimes I think that the things that affect you the most are the things you take for granted and don't really notice are there. Do you know what I mean? And looking back, music has been a big part of my life, not least through my kids, because they're now 35. Tom, my son, is now trained as a jazz pianist, so I had to endure. Can you imagine? And my daughter played piano and clarinet. I think between them they did about 8 instruments. So whether this sort of torture actually had some kind of beneficial effect or not, I don't know. But I certainly lived a lot with it, you know, one way or the other. Yeah.
And did you start writing with young children in the house? I mean, with your two children younger than you started writing?
They were kind of about 10 or 11, that sort of age, yeah. But, you know, at school, so that was good.
And can you say something a little bit about your, some artists aren't very keen on revealing this, but can you say something about your working methods? You know, do you, like for instance, Elizabeth Bishop used to keep lots of little notes, didn't she, and then gradually put them together, and other people have particular writing hours, or, you know, can you say something about how you work as a...
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's changed so much over time. I started off keeping endless notebooks, and I used to do 80 drafts, you know, of one poem, and that was pre-computers, so good thing I'm a very good typist, you know. and it was all very sort of encumbered. Do you know what I mean? All this paper and all this redrafting and all these notebooks and all this. And gradually, I've kind of, you know, pared it all away. And now, I don't keep any notebooks. I write directly onto the computer. And I don't write very often. So, it's getting very spare. Occasionally, if I go on a retreat or something, then I will write in a notebook.
Mm.
Well, mostly because I don't usually take a laptop.
And how do poems sort of begin for you? Do you hear a line in your mind? Do you think, oh, I must write a poem about that? Do you have a mystical moment? What creates a poem for you? How do they start? Or if one even knows that?
Well, I suppose a variety of things. But I think mostly, for me, it starts with that sort of desire to write, even if it's not attached to anything.
Mm.
And it's different to the wish to write, you know, because I always wish to write. But just there can be a moment, a morning, or whatever, that intensifies, and it makes everything feel intensified around you. The very air feels intensified.
Mm.
You know, your listening feels intensified. And you're just there and you don't know what to attach it to. So you just wait and then maybe a word comes or a line comes. I mean, most often it's like that for me. Occasionally it'll be a form that I want to explore. And sometimes it will never ever be subject matter. I never ever think there's something happened or, oh yes, I want to write about that, or in response to public events. Mostly I think, how could I possibly even begin, you know? Occasionally something about language sets me off. I was recently thinking about the use of the conditional tense, and I get all excited. And I suddenly have a vision of this poem all full of woulds and coulds and could have nots and, you know, all this kind of thing. So that can actually quite get me going, you know. But again, I have to find something to attach it.
And what you attach it to is often, is, as you say, a form. So in your latest book, you've got ghazals and sonnet sequences, and a sestina, a beautiful sestina.
Thank you.
And, so you're very attracted. It seems you're very attracted to these forms.
I am. I love them, but I also love free verse, and I've tended to go from book to book, sort of do a more formal book, then a free versey book, then go back to formal. And so the last one, well, the last two actually are quite formal. I'm getting worried, I'm getting a bit stuck in it now. I'd better go and be a bit more sort of experimental and throw lines around the page. Yeah. But I think that they're endlessly fascinating and somehow reliable. You know, they're reliable, they force you to be truthful. In that sense, they're reliable. They find you out, you know, if there's a real poem there or not. So they're very trusty allies, you know. And also in this last book, I was interested in trying to use the forms that might produce the more song-like lyrics that I think, I mean, quite often I'm sort of moved to do something because I'm against something rather than for, you know, or in an attempt to redress an imbalance. So I was thinking that, but why does nobody write poems, you know, like the Elizabethan little sort of songs, you know, like the little songs you find in Shakespeare, or those very memorizable sort of lyrics. And I thought, oh, it's, you know, why am I losing this and this and this? Oh, let me run and try and save something, you know. So this book, I, even before I started writing, I had an image of, it's very patient strong, this is, little poems with like flower borders, you know, and with really audible rhymes and those traditional rhymes and things like that, you know. And it was also, it's a technical challenge because actually they're very difficult to do without being incredibly corny, you know, so things like that sort of get me going.
Because in one of the poems in the Merest Flowers, you're saying poetry's on the run from exhaustion, the inability to imagine a larger world, and one too sick to be hurt into poetry. So maybe wonder what was behind those lines for you. What do you want to see from contemporary poetry? What are you wanting to see?
Well, actually, those lines referring to my own poetry rather than poetry at large, you know, sort of my poetry's on the run and it can't imagine a larger world. I mean, I'm terribly aware of my limitations, not in a kind of miserable way, but just as a fact of life. You know, I'm never going to be tall, am I? You know, so I'm never going to be a certain kind of poet. And part of the limitations is that I very rarely write overtly political or public poems or poetry. And I think that is because of my inability to imagine a larger world. I feel only able to write from my own experience. But of course, that isn't a general, you know, comment on contemporary poetry, which, in fact, quite the opposite. I think quite a lot of poets do manage to do that.
The last question I was going to ask is, it's a rather broad question, but you know, part of the vision of Poetry East is to sort of, and Gat got it right this time as well, so we're into the interviewing, got the right words, is, you know, how poetry, I believe, can enrich consciousness, can help us become more aware. And I wonder whether do you have an image or a vision of poetry having a sort of human and even spiritual effect in your own way of seeing that. I wonder what you thought about that. Or is that, what, I don't know.
Is it too big a question?
Is that a larger world that we're, I mean, it's a rather large question. What is poetry for you?
To be honest, I'm quite humdrum about it. What poetry is for me is that I love doing it. I'm reasonably good at it. I mean, better at it than I would be, say, being a pianist or something. I love reading it. It's very difficult for me to sort of grow outwards from there into a larger statement. I don't know what poetry's for. I almost feel that I can't connect being for, which implies some sort of utility, even if it's spiritual. I can't connect it with my sensation of poetry, if you see what I mean. I think in some sense it's non-utilitarian, however high that, you know, use might be. I suppose I noticed that one of the current cliches on blurbs on poetry books, I'm so glad they didn't give me a quote with it in, though I think I've had it previously, is that they keep on saying, this poet is blah-de-blah, you know, all these wonderful things, and something about, and the poems know what it feels to be human, or something, isn't it right? What it is to be human. This is the big cliche, you know, what it is to be human. Of course, so, you know, every thought one has about poetry becomes kind of, I don't know, turns into dross somehow, you know. I don't know if it makes, I don't really believe that, because some of the most magnificent poetry, I don't think the poets were particularly nice human beings anyway. Do you know what I mean? Sort of, I didn't think it necessarily made them more human or more humane. I mean, in a lot of cases, it just made them more egomaniacal, you know. But for the reader, well, I think for me it's a solace. It's a pleasure. It's a way of losing sense of the self. Actually, I mean, you lose yourself in it, I suppose you do when you read a novel, but in a some slightly different way. I think it does what all arts do. It tries to reach for something that is, that will never ever be attained. But the pleasure is in the reaching.
That sounds, seems to be a wonderful answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.